This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Manchester United are knocked out of the Champions League by Atletico Madrid after curious officiating, with Ralf Rangnick's rant directed at the referee rather than his players. Should Diego Simeone be the new manager at Old Trafford? Sporting integrity's called into question by Chelsea. Somebody pass them a mirror. Big games tonight in the Premier League after Manchester City dropped points against Crystal Palace. We'll also be speaking to a Football Weekly listener who's been delivering supplies on the Poland-Ukrainian border. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Okay, what a panel we have today. Simon Burnton, hello.
Hello.
Jonathan Fadugba, hello.
Good morning.
Lars Siversen, good morning. From
good morning,
the home office. Or your home office.
Home office.
Where are you?
I'm in a sort of side room, the room in which we place everything we don't know where it should go in the house, which very often includes me.
Despite everybody on the pod's election plans, you are not actually in the home office, which is a real shame.
I'm not. I mean, what is it though? I think very little would get done. I'm not an efficient man. More compassionate maybe than the current lot, but not very efficient.
Vote for Lars. Sidlow, you'd vote for Lars, wouldn't you?
Absolutely, I would. Good morning.
Morning. Okay, only one place to start really, isn't there? Manchester United 0, Atletico Madrid 1. After that goal, Sid, from Lodi Dos Santos, was this game only ever going to go one way?
I think it was certainly the way that Atletico Madrid wanted it, to be in a position where they had a lead to defend. And there's been a big kind of debate all year, or at least a big sense of Atletico trying to find themselves and kind of refine that old identity of being defensively strong, of being able to game manage, if you like. And I think it was really important that they got themselves into the lead to be able to do that. And over the last 6 weeks or so, they've started to rediscover a bit of their old selves, because they really haven't been that Atletico that I think is, if you like, this sort of standard image of them. They haven't been defensively strong. They haven't been a team that's been particularly good at ceding possession and let the other team play, but then making sure they don't get too far. And last night, a little bit of that came back. And Simeone post-game was very clear about that. He said, you know, we've defended brilliantly. We've got to not have shame. We've got to not feel ashamed at playing on the counter-attack and playing this way. And I think that was part of what pleased him as much as anything else, was the sense that little bit of the kind of the traditional identity came back.
I can totally see that. From a Manchester United point of view, though, Jonathan, Anthony Elanga in particular had a few opportunities, one glaring miss from close range as well. Do you think he should have perhaps done a bit better than that? I know the ball was coming at him quite quick.
Not particularly. I think if anyone deserves a bit of slack for this season, it's Anthony Elanga. I think he's probably been one of the few bright sparks in Manchester United season, to be honest, if you ask most fans. He was lively again, and I thought it was the correct decision to start him ahead of Marcus Rashford, who didn't really do much when he came on as a replacement. It was a bit bizarre sort of watching the post-match analysis on TV. He was kind of criticised for the goal and not tracking back, which I thought, personally, I thought Diogo Dalot kind of really poor awareness from him, getting out, you know, almost got out of the way of Lodi's effort, kind of seemed to sort of duck it, and which was, I thought, really poor defending. And obviously in transitions, you want your wide players tucking back. But I didn't think Elanga really could be blamed for much over the two legs. He was the one who got the equaliser in the first leg. So I wouldn't have a go at him. I think in general, if you sort of step back and analyse the tie as a whole and Manchester United in the Champions League, did anyone really think they were going to get to the quarterfinals? Even at the start of the season, you know, really, they weren't going to win the Champions League. Going out to this Atletico side, I think, as Sid's just alluded to, they're not a vintage Atleti at the moment. They started to sort of recover their old powers, didn't they, with a bit of skullduggery with the fouling and the constant tactical fouls, which kind of Manchester United couldn't really deal with, to be honest. They couldn't cope with they didn't have that nous of how to actually deal with that kind of side of the game and just focus on their rhythm. They started getting frustrated. Bruno, Ronaldo, players getting really angry. But no, I don't think it was really Elanga's fault. I just think in general, they didn't know how to manage the second half. I thought that some of the substitutions were quite strange. Really, by the end of the game, it was just a mishmash of random players, which kind of sums up Manchester United's past sort of 8 years, really. And I thought the decision to take Fred off was quite strange, because for me, he was United's best player. So I don't think you'd really expect United to go much further, even if they had qualified. But of course, it's a disappointing result in a context of what is really quite a sort of miserable, forgettable season.
And you say that they didn't handle the fouls and everything else, but surely that's part of the game plan beforehand. They would know that Atletico were going to do that, and Ralph Rangnick would prepare his players to not get frustrated, you'd think. But it was defensive lapses again, Simon, that let United down. They were claiming fouls in the build-up, particularly that one with Anthony Elanga just before the goal. The referee did put his whistle to his lips. Harry Maguire absolutely furious about it. What did you think?
I thought it probably, on overall balance of probabilities, was not a foul. Obviously, the two players came together. I mean, it was hard to see which one initiated the contact. And even after it, it seemed like Elanga stumbled rather than that he was forced to ground. I thought the referee tended to allow play to continue when there were kind of question mark fouls, and I enjoyed that. You know, generally, he was very strongly criticised on commentary and kind of in the wider public on Twitter by Ralph Rangnick. I think he could have handled the time wasting and general shithousery better. But I think that over the first hour of the game, I thought he did a pretty good job. To come out of that game and say, well, it was the referee's fault because it was a foul before the goal, it makes no sense to me at all.
It's a bit lazy, isn't it, Lars? But actually, you know, as Simon said there, Twitter was full of the referee being poor. I mean, generally, I didn't think it was a particularly good performance.
From the referee or from everyone involved?
from Manchester United, but from the referee is what my question means.
I was actually about to tweet something nice about the referee in the first half, because he did a thing. One of my bugbears in football is that players like, oh, someone touched me, and then they sort of lie down and expect to get a foul. It annoys me, and it happened a few times, to a slight extent, to Elanga, though I think he's just used to getting fouls if you feel someone touching you. And also Bruno Fernandes in the box looking for a penalty. Like, you see, his legs were flopping while he was still in the air. Like, I'm not sure what might... Was it cattle prod? Like, do Atletico Madrid players now carry cattle prods around them, I wonder? Because Fernandes' legs were already, like, flopping about before he fell down. Anyway, I like them, but you're right. The time wasting and shenanigans could have been managed better by the referees, but good Lord, they could have been managed better by the Man United players as well. Because when Atleti are doing that, they're trying to get United players frustrated. They're trying to get them to spend more time on the referee than on getting back into the game. And that's exactly what they did. So yes, maybe Rangnick could have done more to prepare them for that. But some of these players are senior professionals who you expect to cope with that much better.
I've got a very simple question here, and obviously I'm entirely outnumbered, which is why I asked this simple question. Coming at it from Spain and seeing from here and seeing from someone who's watched a lot of Atletico Madrid, I was very struck by how much of the focus, and including from Rangnick, and obviously, look, I realise that when your team's just lost, everybody's angry, and so perhaps it gets exaggerated a little bit, but how much of the focus was on the shithousery from Atletico. I don't know if I've become desensitised to this, but I didn't think last night. But I genuinely didn't think last night was bad at all. But in a broad context, I didn't think it was particularly extreme. I didn't think there was any one particular decision that was bad. It's true, I think that there is a kind of, if you like, a general trend towards maybe Atletico being able to slow the game down and take the sting out of it. But I didn't see some of the, if you like, the worst excesses of that shithousery, and I really didn't think. And this is why I ask rather than offer this as a statement. I didn't think at the end of the game that this was the explanation for anything. I really didn't. I didn't think, oh, well, this is... Man United have lost because Atletico have put in a masterclass of shithousery. It seemed to me to be relatively mild as these things tend to go, which is why I offer this up as a question rather than as a statement.
Jonathan, do you want to take that question? You're a United fan, aren't you?
I kind of agree with Sid, to be honest. It wasn't like kind of elite level... I didn't actually know I could get away with saying shithousery. That's why I went for skullduggery earlier. Yeah.
Skullduggery is a quality word.
Far too polite for the rest of us.
Yeah. I'm very happy to say shithousery. So yeah, I mean, I didn't actually think it was that kind of devious from Atletico. Like Sid said, I've seen a lot more devious performances. And it was quite comedy seeing him running off down the touchline. He plays the bad guy character so well, and getting, well, pelters at him, didn't he? Got a few bottles chucked at him, I think, as well, which wasn't great. I'm sure there'll be an investigation into that maybe. But I didn't think really it was something like that he shouldn't, that the Manchester United team shouldn't have been aware of. And I think United actually bought into it more than they needed to. And that, I think that was what the problem was. They were moaning at every decision. You know, the Elanga decision, for example. I think Ronaldo did the sort of, you know, referee you need glasses, peepers type thing, didn't he? And kind of just getting frustrated at every little thing. And I just think that kind of sums up Manchester United, really, rather than says much about Atletico. I think any little thing that goes against them is kind of everyone's looking for, every individual's looking for someone else to blame. And there's just not that real togetherness. You can imagine if it had been sort of a Liverpool or Manchester City, they find a way around that and they just get back into their rhythm and start just playing the game and using that momentum. United in the second half just didn't have any real momentum to their possession. No real build-up play. You know, who's the source of kind of creativity? There's no one really there. Everyone relying on everyone else. And so, yeah, no, I agree with Sid. I didn't really think that it was something that was... I thought the referee's performance was the problem, because there were some fouls that he maybe let go that you would expect maybe to be given. But when you're an experienced European side, you know that you can't rely on that. And I don't think you can use that as an excuse, really.
No, too many excuses and too much negativity, I would say. Melvin has a question for you, Sid. When did Atletico Madrid's three centre-backs last have an easier game? And then he's got one for everyone, which I'll put out to you in a minute. When did you lose count of the number of half-hearted crosses that said centre-halves had to head away easily?
Yeah, there was a moment in the commentary last night, in the Spanish commentary, obviously. And again, you know, I think we are actually conditioned by the commentary as well in terms of the response to it. And obviously, someone mentioned earlier that the idea that in the UK commentary, there was kind of complaints about Atletico's approach really quite early on. And again, I think you're conditioned by that. There weren't any in Spain, which obviously comes from where you're coming from as well. But there was a moment in the commentary about 10 or 15 minutes to go, I think, when one of the co-commentators said something like, United will start putting the ball in the box now. Now it's up to Atletico centre-backs to be strong in the air and head all of these crosses away. And I must admit, I sat there and thought, they've kind of done that all game, haven't they? And it never really felt like this was particularly problematic. Atletico said at the very start, they've had such a strange season because they have played better football than in the last 6 weeks, but not got better results. This is now 5 wins out of 6, which includes the 2 Man United games, 4 wins a row in La Liga, which hadn't happened all year. And yet you don't look at them now and say, oh, they're suddenly playing really well. And one of the things that's happened is throughout the course of the year, they've made silly individual mistakes defensively all the way through the year. When actually the rest of what they're doing hasn't been that bad. I think last night there was possibly a sense of embracing that, which is, I think, why they dealt with it so comfortably. I think they largely kept United away from creating really good chances. And I think in that sense, it was relatively easy. Although that said, I think there was a recognition last night that the importance of Jimenez and Savic, and obviously that's only 2 of the 3 central defenders, and Reinildo, who is a new signing in the winter window, who everybody thought was coming as left back and has actually come as the left side of a back three. That's really changed things, because they've had problems with Felipe earlier in the season. They've had problems with Hermoso earlier in the season. And in that spell in which they suddenly started conceding lots of goals, usually Jimenez or Savic was missing. So I think it's partly about personnel as well as the nature of the game itself.
Can I also just say, as half statement, half question to Sid, I think it mattered that we had old Jan Oblak again yesterday. He made some really
absolutely.
Good saves. Because I've been looking into this, like, if you just look at the league table, yes, they've conceded a lot of goals, but they've also conceded the fewest shots per game and the fewest expected goals against per game in La Liga. So the numbers would back up what you're saying about the defending not being good. Oh, not being bad, sorry.
No, I mean, look, and this is one of the things that we've been trying to get our heads around all season, is that in this period in which Atletico were losing games that they shouldn't do, you look at the underlying statistics, and as you say, the shots faced, well, this should be defensively the best team in La Liga, even if there were little individual errors here and there. And then that does lead you to Oblak. So you look at the statistics, and I haven't got them in front of me, maybe you have, but Oblak's shots saved stats were miles off what they've been over the last 4 or 5 years. A long, long way. I think they were up at only around about 50%, having previously been up at kind of 75, 76, something like that. I'm inventing those figures, but they were more or less in that region, I think. And it just hasn't happened. And all season, you've watched Oblak and thought, he's not terrible by any means, but he's just not saving things in the way that he once was. And I think last night was really important for him. In fact, Simeone even said this post-game. He was talking about it, as he often does in big games, and trying to find something to say about every player. And when he got to Oblak, he used this phrase. He said, Oblak went back to giving us the security that we need. And obviously, implicitly, what he's saying is all season we haven't felt this. And as I say, it hasn't been that Oblak has played terribly.
Wow.
It's just that he hasn't been that that phenomenal goalkeeper that he was in the past. I think he's been a little bit reluctant to come off his line and catch crosses. It's just been a lack of a certain insecurity about him. And last night, I think you're right, that was very important as well. The fact that he saved the first one with his face obviously also tells you, however much we analyse things, there's always an element of luck as well.
Okay, so very briefly, since you mentioned the stats,
have you got them?
There is a metric that goes that's to do with post-shot expected goals. It's a little bit sort of controversial, but it's essentially shots on target faced, adjusted for how dangerous the shots were, minus the ones you actually concede, if you know what I mean. And the reason
that's subjective, though.
And the reason they have statistical modeling and this sort of thing. The reason I bring it up is that last season, Oblak was the best goalkeeper in La Liga by this metric, and he's been consistently been right near the top, whereas this season he has been actually the worst in La Liga by this metric, I believe. Let me just double check that, because just those words leaving my mouth sounds weird. But yes, according to the Stats Bombs model through FB Ref, he has actually been the least good goalkeeper measured by sort of post shot expected goals. So that totally backs up what you're saying, certainly, and what's been my impression.
As I say, it's not like you look at this season and think, well, there's a terrible mistake, there's a terrible mistake, there's a terrible mistake. There hasn't been really. Been maybe one or two. But it's just been that sense that, oh, that guy that used to save us a lot just kind of isn't doing it this year.
I did think that his save for there were two great saves in the match. The one that hit his head, that he obviously his positioning was grand, but he knew nothing about it. And the Varane header. And I thought his positioning for the Varane header was really interesting, because I would expect a goalkeeper to stay approximately central in his goal. And if a header went bang into either corner, they'd be beaten, but they would play the percentages. Whereas he went and stood right by the far post. And if the header had gone anywhere else, he'd have looked a little stupid. But as it is, it went right to the top corner and he could claw it away and make the save look relatively straightforward. And I don't know, it was just, I was really struck by his positioning. And then, you know, the last moment of the match when they take a corner and he comes, claims, and it was fairly straightforward, but the fact the match ended in that moment made him feel even more like a decisive character in the match.
Yeah, yeah. The one that I really liked was after that save, you say, from the Varane header, was how kind of nonchalantly he then caught the follow-up. He sort of just reached up his hand like a basketball player and kind of one-handedly said, oh, all right then.
Sid, we've managed to do, I don't know how long we've done on Manchester United, and only mention Cristiano Ronaldo once, which in itself is a wonderful feat. Do you think that was potentially Cristiano Ronaldo's last Champions League game?
To be honest with you, I say this as someone who's not following him at Manchester United and wasn't following him at Juventus. This is the first time, by the way, that he's been knocked out by Atletico. He'd knocked them out every other time he'd faced them. My feeling would be probably not, because I can't help but think that either he stays at United. Mind you, United aren't going to get a Champions League place.
I was just going to say that. Not at this rate.
Yeah, that's true. That's me just making the sort of the normal Man United play Champions League assumption. But actually, no, that's quite likely that's not the case. And the other thing is, if he's to move on, presumably he, at very least, now that's not to say he necessarily gets what he wants, he would be looking at Champions League clubs only, wouldn't he, to continue, even if it means maybe going to a sort of a lower tier Champions League club. I don't know about you, but there's a little bit of me that thinks, sort of floating in the background, isn't sort of the shelter for formerly great players, PSG, going to become an option at some point?
I was about to say, I mean, I've been thinking about this. It makes perfect sense, because he's absolutely not what the team needs in the sporting sense, but he would be great for the brand, which in a nutshell is the ultimate PSG signing. So I think this seems very likely to happen.
Yeah, elsewhere in Spain, Sid, we've talked about this before, haven't we? But it's been confirmed now. Barcelona have signed a shirt and stadium sponsorship deal with audio streaming platform Spotify. The brand's going to appear on the front of the men's and women's team shirts for four seasons from the 2022-23 campaign. The company's also going to be the first brand, this always just makes me feel a little bit queasy, to sponsor the club stadium, which will now be called Spotify Camp Nou. How's that going to go down in Spain?
Well, the beauty of this is that because it's going to be known as the Spotify Camp Nou, it's going to be known as the Camp Nou. If you put a sponsor's name on the existing name, the sponsor's name just ends up disappearing, doesn't it? I mean, there may be some obligation in commercial circles. And I don't know if the media might be obliged to use Spotify, but I think most people fundamentally won't. And so whenever you have surname rights rather than naming rights, it always seems to me that fundamentally not very much happens. I quite like the line last night that said in the statement, said something along the lines of, we're going to bring football and music closer together than ever before. And I thought the bringing together of football and music hasn't always been hugely successful. Although as someone who did a radio show on football and music in Spain for a couple of years, there are some surprisingly good football songs out there, honestly.
Really?
My question would be now, after the Barca anthem, will it just immediately go to an incredibly annoying ad before the game can start? Before the game,
it'll give you the Champions League anthem, the Barcelona anthem, and then something that the algorithm has told you is a bit like those two.
Right, there was another game in the Champions League last night. Benfica advancing to the quarter-final stage for a fourth time after knocking out Ajax 1-0 on the night, that was. They've never gone beyond the quarter-final stage in the Champions League, mind you, but this was the first time they'd reached it since 2015-16. Darwin Nunes' goal was the difference, his 25th of the season. Benfica's only effort on target. That's all you need, though, isn't it, sometimes? Ajax, one of the best sides in the group stage, but what went wrong for them, Simon?
Statistically, it looked like a very one-sided game. There was Ajax had a whole string of chances, of great shooting opportunities spurned. The killer stat is that they had 16 shots and only two on target. They just weren't at it. You know, they got as far as the penalty area, and then lack of composure, lack of quality. I don't know. It was your classic smash and grab. Benfica should have lost by a big old margin. And unlike Manchester United, Ajax don't have anyone else they can blame, really. They had the possession, they had the opportunities. They just didn't score.
Darwin Nunes is a player, by the way. I think he's going to end up somewhere big. I think there's been rumours about Newcastle, which would surprise me, but obviously they have the money. There's been reports of course, sort of 80 to 90 million euros worth. If I was looking at Manchester United, obviously going back to them and their problems and where they go from here, and obviously you mentioned Ronaldo, Faye, if they're looking for a striker, I'd be looking at Nunes all day long, 22-year-old Uruguayan. He's got kind of a bit of Cavani-esque about him in my way, like a young Cavani, kind of 22 years old, and he can score goals with a header. Obviously the goal yesterday was a header. Scores goals on his right foot, can finish off his left as well. I really like him as a player, and I think we're going to hear a lot more about him in the years to come. But yeah, it's strange one for Ajax because they've had such a good season in Europe and then kind of ended with a whimper. You know, for Benfica, it's huge to get that far. But I wonder now where that leaves Ajax, because obviously they're still in a title fight. But the Erik ten Hag rumours are obviously going to start to maybe intensify now as potentially the next United manager. Sorry to keep going back to United. But yeah, that's another sort of storyline, isn't it, to come in the next few weeks, probably.
Well, yeah, interesting observation that Mauricio Pochettino, Ten Hag and Ralf Rangnick, all the three favourites for the Manchester United job, all out of the Champions League in the round of 16, Lars.
It's almost as if judging a manager's capability on like one-off knockout ties is really dumb. I don't know. Maybe we shouldn't do that.
Maybe not.
The question at this point becomes, to what extent will Manchester United do that? Because it's all well and good us talking about it. The question is how United are managing this search.
Well, I do want to draw our attention to a very well-made point by Colin Millar on Twitter, because, you know, Michael Owen did question this after the game. Can Manchester United take a manager who's just been knocked out by Benfica? Colin Millar pointing out that Michael Owen was part of Sir Alex Ferguson's Manchester United squad that was knocked out of the Champions League group stage by Benfica. So maybe Michael Owen actually knows the answer to that question, if he has a think.
Brilliant. Sid, it's been a pleasure, as it always is. I know you've got a crack on and I've work to do.
Thank you. Real pleasure. Cheerio.
Right, that's it for part one. In part two, we'll talk Premier League and, of course, that Chelsea statement. Welcome back to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. There was a game on Monday night, of course. It finished Crystal Palace 0, Manchester City 0. Bernardo Silva said his side are still in a better position than Liverpool, which is technically true, of course, but the pressure is really on them now, isn't it, Simon?
It is, and there's a chink of light. You know, there was a point where they were far enough ahead, given their quality and the consistency of their results, for it to seem unassailable, and that's no longer the case. I really enjoyed this game on Monday. I have a historical antipathy towards Crystal Palace that goes back to Sasa Cercic diving to win a penalty against Watford at some point, I mean, God knows how long ago. But I am really enjoying this vintage. Partly, I mean, I didn't expect Vieira's impact to be so positive. I really liked their recruitment last summer. They've got a really enjoyable squad full of young players who entertain, you know, quality defenders, interesting forwards. The commitment of their performance on Monday night was, I mean, it was really impossible to criticise. You know, there are lots of teams who attempt to do this to Manchester City, and most of them don't make it. You know, at halftime, with half an hour to go, I thought, I've seen this film before, I've seen this movie, and it ends with a couple of late goals. And it had a feeling of inevitability about it until maybe the 80th, the 85th, the 87th, you're still thinking, you know, we've been here before. You know, Vincent Kompany's going to come on and lash one in from 30 yards or whatever they need to do. The intensity, Crystal Palace's intensity never wavered. They always had someone getting a foot in. City had chances, obviously. Clear chances, really very few. There was the Bernardo Silva one that he should have, from Grealish's low cross, that he connected with and somehow steered wide of the far post. And that was the best they had, really. It was a Crystal Palace story rather than a Manchester City story for me. It was a
Yeah, do you know what? I'm really glad you said that, Simon, because I do get frustrated sometimes that we always do end up focusing on the title race, which of course is key, and not give any credence to table to sides, particularly in mid-table when we get to this stage of the season. But Patrick Vieira, is, as you said, has done a fantastic job. Four games unbeaten now in the Premier League. They're in 11th. And to do that against Manchester City without being patronising in the slightest was really impressive. Palace so good though, Conor Gallagher especially, Jonathan, and he gave such a lovely post-match interview as well, which just shows the effort that was put into this game. He said, "I'm struggling to talk, my legs are gone."
Yeah, he's had a really good season, and I imagine, well, who knows what will happen with Chelsea, but I imagine if all things were normal, Thomas Tuchel would probably be looking at him as a player for them for next season, because he's been really, really good. I mean, Manchester City struggled. This is not the first time they've struggled against Crystal Palace. Obviously lost at home 2-0 back in October, and I think it's worrying for a Premier League title-chasing team to get, what is it, 1 point from four games against... two against Tottenham, two against Crystal Palace. So I think there's a cause for concern there. I would give advantage now to Liverpool. I think they have a slightly stronger attack. And I thought the game was interesting. I mean, when you look for storylines, the sort of Jack Grealish 2 goals, 2 assists in 19 games, £100 million is an interesting one to me. Has he had a huge impact? I thought it was quite odd that Guardiola, not that I would ever question him, didn't obviously make any substitutions. Perhaps felt that the rhythm of the game would weigh in their favour eventually. But, you know, when you looked at the options he had on the bench, it seemed to me in the latter stages of the match to not change things was an indication he either wanted to just keep things and rest players or maybe didn't have quite full faith in the players on the bench.
How can you not have faith in the players on the bench? I mean, Raheem Sterling has scored 7 goals against Palace for Manchester City. Maybe he's got a niggle, maybe.
Possibly. I mean, I would have had him on in the second half, certainly, because Palace, I mean, a lot of the, you know, players like Foden, for example, who played, a lot of the players kind of in front of the defenders. And by the way, you mentioned giving credit to Palace. The two centre-backs have had really good seasons, and I think they performed well. But they didn't really have, there was no one, you know, Foden, someone who's going to withdraw and drop deeper. It's probably easier for them to defend against that. So, yeah, it was a strange game, and it kind of just ebbed out in the end, as Simon's mentioned. But, yeah, I think that's an advantage of Liverpool now. It's quite funny that everybody was saying about 2 or 3 weeks ago that Manchester City have ruined football and the Premier League's over now. You know, it's the era of dominance. They're going to be here forever. And like a month later or so, they're barely, you know, back at this level now. Is it 50-50?
Yeah, if only everything that people didn't ever write or tweet or anything be accessible on the internet forever, we'd all just get away with it, wouldn't we? Liverpool-Man City on April the 10th, though, absolutely massive now, unless Liverpool drop points against Arsenal tonight, Lars, which is a huge game, isn't it, for both sides. Arsenal with all those games in hand, looking to cement their top four place and get Champions League football for the first time since 2016, I think it is. How do you see this going? I don't even know how to preview this game, but two sides in amazing form and a fixture that always produces goals.
Arsenal, it's an interesting test of Arsenal because they've been sort of chugging along very nicely and they've actually consistently been picking up wins, unlike any of their sort of Champions League chasing rivals. But of course, against not the most ferocious opponents, but then you look back at the Man City game in which they were very good and really harshly done by, I thought, in losing. So, they were very good for the first hour and then Gabriel got sent off. Anyway, it's an interesting test of Arsenal's mettle. I can't fully let go the notion that it's completely 50-50 near the top of the table now. I mean, I don't think it is. I still think City still have a slight advantage points-wise, and they are also a very, very good team. And, looking at the betting odds, if you genuinely believe it's 50-50, you really want to put money down on Liverpool to win the league, because that's not the assessment of the betting markets at the moment. I still have City as favourites there. But no, it should be a fun game. Everyone is very exciting times for really Arsenal and Tottenham tonight, because Tottenham have this sort of win-loss thing they do, and they play Brighton. Since they lost last, presumably they should win now, and they really need it to avoid being sort of decoupled entirely in the Champions League chase.
Lars has touched on the other game, Brighton in awful, awful form at the moment against Tottenham at the Amex. I mean, look, we're not going to focus too much on it because it'll be out of date very soon, but how do you see this one going?
Brighton's form is abysmal. I, again, really like them. I think that they're a really well-coached side that have some recruitment issues to resolve. Obviously, they need a striker who's a more convincing striker who converts chances more reliably. And I think that Tottenham have too much for them if they turn up. I expect an away win, but I really like Brighton, and I'm not tearing my hair out at their poor form, nor getting carried away when they have good spells of form. They're a really positive, well-coached side on a upwards trajectory, and but you need kind of long-term vision. I know the sport isn't particularly good at that, but I think they're in a good place. I mean, not right this minute, but generally look forward to watching them grow in the future.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. Disappointing that their season should kind of peter out in this way, bearing in mind how good they were at the beginning of the season. Right, let's focus on Chelsea, shall we? And the cry for sporting integrity. I mean, just the strangest thing yesterday.
Strange is a word. I have other words you can use about it, but let's go with strange for now. It's a very polite version.
There's a number of adjectives, Lars, for sure. Let me just, in case any of you have missed it yesterday, go through chronologically exactly what happened. So this is all obviously before the FA Cup quarterfinal on Saturday against Middlesbrough. Chelsea released this statement. We're disappointed to announce we won't be able to sell tickets for Saturday's FA Cup tie at Middlesbrough, despite engaging in extensive discussions with the Office of Financial Sanctions Implementation. The deadline to purchase away tickets has passed without appropriate amendments being made to the government licence, which would allow a full allocation of Chelsea supporters to attend. Executives at Middlesbrough had been kind enough to extend their deadline for ticket sales and stadium allocation from 7:30 last night until 9:30 a.m. this morning. That was obviously Tuesday. It's important for the competition that the match against Middlesbrough goes ahead. However, it's with extreme reluctance that we're asking the FA board to direct that the game be played behind closed doors for matters of sporting integrity. Chelsea FC recognises that such an outcome would have a huge impact on Middlesbrough and its supporters, as well as our own fans who've already bought the limited number of tickets that were sold before the licence was imposed. But we believe this is the fairest way of proceeding in the current circumstances. I mean, just not a good look, Simon, was it?
Sporting integrity were the last two words that they wanted to put in their press release. I understand that they're frustrated that they're not even being allowed to give tickets away and that they can't sell things. They can't have cash flow. That is part of the sanctions and that is understandable. If they wanted to give their tickets away, you'd have thought they should be able to, but they were waiting for confirmation from the sanctions office that this is possible and didn't receive it in time. And that's frustrating. However, sporting integrity, Jesus. And they've got £1.5 billion worth of questionable money that has powered them to 5 league titles, 2 European Cups, World Club Cup, multiple FA Cups. The sporting, like the clubs like Chelsea have done so much to harm sporting integrity of this most beloved sport. And they cannot, but it literally blows my mind that they can, that they feel that they can use that as an argument in their favour after all these years. And that they really just need to sit down and have a good look at themselves. It was so crass, so tasteless, so thoughtless. Like I say, I understand they want fans there, and they were willing to give those tickets away to their fans, and they weren't allowed to do it. Annoying, but don't come talk about sporting integrity to me, because you have no right.
Or to any of us. I think everybody's jaws hit the floor when that statement was released yesterday. Whitehall officials saying they'd seen Chelsea's statement with disbelief after making concessions to the club by changing parts of the licence last weekend. You know, they're already being given help. One senior government source saying Chelsea's behaviour was like a drowning person in shark-infested waters complaining that they aren't on an oligarch's yacht and threatening the people throwing them a life ring.
Yeah, but I think that's a very good point, actually. And listen, I apologize in advance. I have some things to say. I think we should be very clear about what the situation at Chelsea is actually right now, because I feel like a lot of people haven't quite grasped it, which is fine, by the way, because this is new territory. It's a hard thing to get your head around. And if you listen to one of the pods last week, you will hear the sound of me really struggling to get my head around it. So I'm not judging anyone here, but let's just be very clear. The fundamental situation is, because the way football works in this country, football clubs are companies who, like any other, can be bought and sold. I don't really agree with that, but that's what it is. So Chelsea Football Club is an asset owned by Roman Abramovich, in the same way he might own a kebab shop or Diggerland in Kent, you know? Because according to the government, Abramovich has benefited from his relationship with a despot who is currently committing war crimes and causing the deaths of thousands of innocent civilians. The government has frozen his assets. Now, when an asset is frozen, that means trading stops. No transactions of any kind in and out. You know, kebab shop is closed. The diggers have been switched off. You know, no trading can happen until sanctions are lifted or there's a change of ownership. That's where Chelsea are right now. Strictly speaking, Chelsea should not be able to conduct any activity commercially of any kind right now. But the government has generously and probably correctly allowed Chelsea to continue operating in a very limited way so they can fulfill their fixtures. You know, you see a lot of people moaning about Chelsea being punished. The opposite is true. A very special exemption has been made for Chelsea so they can fulfill their fixtures. And that's been done largely because of the goodwill and sympathy the government has for the football club. You know, by rights, Chelsea shouldn't be able to fulfill their fixtures right now. So really, arguing that Middlesbrough fans shouldn't be able to watch their games because of sporting integrity is mad. I mean, it's completely off the wall mad. And I've already spoken for too long, but like, really, let's talk about sporting integrity here. The only reason Chelsea have been successful and won trophies the last 18 years is money from Roman Abramovich. The players have done great stuff on the pitch, but they're there because of the money. Chelsea can't pay their own bills. So they've enjoyed the sporting benefits of having this owner. Now the club is a frozen asset because of the owner. You know, the big Russian chicken has come home to roost, yet the government is very kindly shielding them from the consequences, which is nice. But you know what? If we want to talk about sporting integrity, that is a place I would perhaps start. If you lose points to Chelsea between now and the end of the season, or whenever they're sold, sporting integrity is a word that would be on my mind if I was a club that loses points to this Chelsea team right now.
Yeah, and to be honest, that statement itself, you know, dug them a massive hole, if you use your Diggerland analogy. The Borough statement, though, Jonathan, I thought was absolutely quality. We're aware of Chelsea's request to have Saturday's Emirates FA Cup six-round tie played behind closed doors and find their suggestion both bizarre and without any merit whatsoever. All concerned are well aware of the reasons Chelsea have been sanctioned and that this has nothing to do with Middlesbrough Football Club. To suggest, as a result, that Middlesbrough FC and our fans should be penalised is not only grossly unfair, but without any foundation. Given the reasons for these sanctions, for Chelsea to seek to invoke sporting integrity as a reason for the game being played behind closed doors is ironic in the extreme. We currently await formal notification from the FA of the next steps, which they did then get, but rest assured, Middlesbrough will resist Chelsea's actions in the strongest terms. And I think everybody gave round of applause emojis for that robust statement, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, I think Chelsea are entitled to probably try it. I think it was probably just a cheeky request and it's been denied. I think Lars has pretty much summed it up, really.
Got to read the room, though, haven't you? Surely.
I mean, to be fair, I've said all the words. So, I mean, sorry for that. But I thought Middlesbrough did really well to get through that statement without swearing or suggesting that Chelsea should be immediately relocated to the North Sea.
Okay, the FA then said the following. After constructive talks between the FA and Chelsea, the club has now agreed to remove their request for the Emirates FA Cup quarterfinal tie against Middlesbrough to be played behind closed doors. The FA remains in ongoing discussions with Chelsea, the Premier League and the government to find a solution that would enable both Chelsea fans to attend games and away fans to attend Stamford Bridge while ensuring sanctions are still respected. We should obviously say here, as always, that Roman Abramovich vehemently denies any links to Vladimir Putin or that his wealth was amassed through criminality. Nag says, Simon, is Middlesbrough putting the away tickets up for sale yesterday the ultimate bit of shithousery after all that's happened and should obviously be applauded, is what he says in brackets.
It was quite funny that Middlesbrough's next statement was 3,500 extra tickets are up for sale. Yeah. Good on them for that. I do think that if back in 2003, you'd have gone to any Chelsea fan and said, listen, you can choose. Either we're going to sell your club to this slightly dodgy businessman, and over the next 22 years, you're going to win everything multiple times. Or we're not. But if you go for it, you're going to win everything. But then after that, the wheels might come off a bit. I think most Chelsea fans would say, I'll watch my team win everything, thank you. And I'll take the risk of what comes after. I don't know. I feel that there's more anger than there might be coming from Chelsea. And that's what the statement reflected yesterday as well. They've had a very sun-kissed run for quite a long time. And, you know, whatever the repercussions are, however it ends, it was probably worth it for the fun they had along the way.
That's it for part two. Part three, we'll be speaking to Football Weekly listener Finn, who joins us having been on the Ukrainian-Poland border.
Hello, Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland here. I now have my own US politics podcast, which is, helpfully, called Politics Weekly America. So if you want to hear my interviews with politicians like Hillary Clinton or expert analysis from Guardian journalists and the latest news from Washington, D.C. and beyond, you should subscribe. To do that, just type Politics Weekly America into Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be there every Friday.
Welcome back to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Very much looking forward to this conversation because Football Weekly listeners Finn and Richard are with us. This is after Finn got in touch with the show because both of you are big Football Weekly listeners. You've been doing some fundraising, haven't you, Finn? Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so Dad texted me about a week ago saying that he wanted to go to the Ukraine border and... I mean, we've just been watching the news like everyone else, feeling a bit helpless. So when he suggested that, I was really keen to go. So we just filled a van, got in touch with some people, filled a van with supplies. Everyone was being very generous with their donations. So we managed to get a van full. And then we headed out there and started a fundraising page, which really kicked off as well, which meant that we were able to, while on the border, able to run back and forth from the shop and fill the van with supplies.
Amazing. So you were out there for 5 days, is that right? How much were you able to help?
Yeah, it was. We were there for about a week in the end. So once we'd done the initial drop, we, as Finn said, we did the fundraising and we set £1,500 as a target. We ended up doing about almost 30,000 in the end. So we were just spending sort of 16, 18 hours a day in the van going to various shops, picking up goods to order. So we initially started out doing it for a charity called Caritas, which is on the ground there, a Polish aid agency that's linked to the Red Cross. So that was our initial goal, was to supply those guys. But once we got there, you know, we started meeting other people and you start to see the needs basically that are there. And it's not just food, it's not just clothing. You know, there's all sorts of basics that they're just not getting. And, you know, the Poles are doing an unbelievable job out there. I mean, one of the things I think that struck Finn and I was you'd have to question whether or not, you know, we would be quite so welcoming and so, you know, engaged with a million people coming across our border in such a short space of time, because we didn't hear anybody complaining at all. And they just wanted to help. And we found that, you know, really inspirational. So we found ourselves, you know, going to these guys in various different places and saying, what do you need? You know, we've got a van, we've got money, you know, we've got a kind of work ethic and we just want to help. So actually what we ended up doing was running things like, you know, just basic stuff like bras and pants and stuff that people just aren't getting. And of course, food, you know, is the big one.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what it is that people are needing more than anything, because of course there's a lot of fundraising going on, a lot of requests for help, but what is it that we can all do that would be the most helpful thing?
It changed quite a lot, didn't it, from depot to depot? But it was tinned food that you can just grab and go, because they don't want them to be in the one place for too long. It's very much like, come in, like they said, they described it as a bus stop. They were saying, come in and then we want to go and get them on their way as quick as possible. So food that you can just grab and go, sleeping bags, blankets.
Yeah, I mean, it's all just basic stuff. I think that the biggest thing the biggest takeaway for us from there and what people can do is that there's a lot of talk about people coming to the UK and refugees coming to the UK. I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't a huge number who want to come here, actually, because one of the big things that we were getting from people was they don't want to move away from home. And we had some conversations with different people that they really struck you, where people said, you know, where are you going to go? Where do you want to be? You can go to this place, that's what, and said, no, I want to go home. And I think if you've just left your husband or your son or your dad or your brother or your uncle or whatever at the border, which they're all having to do, and it, you know, it is just women, children and the elderly coming across the border, and that's really striking when you see that, you're not going to want to move far away. I said to my wife last night about it, and when I got back and I was talking about it, and I said, what would you do? And she said, no, I mean, I'd stay on that border because I wouldn't want to be far from you guys. So they're not wanting to go and be distributed places. So I think that the biggest thing that people can do is to lean in and help the Polish and the Moldovans and the Slovakians and all the people that are going to take the burden of this. You know, and that's the best thing that we can possibly do. I think we can just provide that support. And then for the people that do come over and do come to the UK, you know, obviously to be as welcoming as we possibly can, because these are traumatised people.
Yeah, they really are. Are you planning on going back? How much more can you raise, and what more can we do in terms of your fundraising?
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, we, you know, these things, we've never done anything like this before. And you know, I think like lots of people, it's really struck home and you know, we definitely want to do something for the longer term. So there's a number of different things that we want to try and do. One of them is to set up a supply chain, basically, for one of the groups that we met. So a lot of them are, you know, for example, people like Caritas. We met people coming in from all over Europe to support Caritas. But the last place that we went to, I'm going to butcher this for any of your Polish listeners, by the way. So it's Leżnica, I think it is. We went to there, and actually that was really striking. It was the last place we went to, and there's a huge Ukrainian population there, so a lot of them have poured into it. And it's a, you know, it's a smallish town, and they're really overwhelmed, and they're not getting the support that they should probably need. So I think what we're going to try and do is set something up for them directly. So we're now in contact with people on the ground there. But I think the other thing that we would like to do is perhaps to look at the piece around refugees coming into to Brighton, where we live. You know, how do we support them with things like housing? You know, I think what's being offered at the moment is without getting into the politics of it, it feels pretty ill thought through and very short term. You know, and I think that what we need to do is make sure that we provide something that's a bit longer term for people. If it is going to be a long term, you know, hopefully it won't be, but I think the feeling is that it might be. You know, and to make sure that we do what we can to help those people. But the other thing is that there are volunteers needed on the border. And we met an amazing guy out there who was he was an English guy wearing a kilt, making soup for people and shouting at them as they came across the border and handed it. It was quite bizarre, but it worked, you know, yeah, and people were very into it. But he's got a job, right? And he can't do that forever. So we're in touch with him about trying to maybe organise groups of volunteers to go over there for a week to man this thing. And it's a 24-hour job, basically, to provide food and, you know, they've got tents running there because people are coming across the border. And we were there on the border at night, you know, the middle of the night, it's minus 10, you know, and people are coming over without sufficient equipment and sufficient clothing. And, you know, they just want a hot meal and, you know, a smile, basically. It's not a huge thing to ask from, you know, from people to be able to provide, I don't think. So that's the other thing that we'd like to try and do is to organise groups of people who might want to go out there. So if anybody wants to get in touch with us through the Instagram account, so it's just finn.paisley. And if they're interested in any of those things, then, you know, we'd be delighted to have a conversation to point them in the right direction.
That's perfect. I was just going to ask you exactly that. I'll be on there for sure. Thank you so much, both of you, Finn and Richard, for joining us. I really appreciate it. And well done on all the efforts you're doing as well.
Thank you.
Cheers, Faye.
Good luck for Leicester as well. I know football is completely irrelevant, but good luck for Leicester in the inaugural Europa League conference.
Yeah, well, I mean, that we were saying the only other time we've been to Poland was the away match against Warsaw last in October, which we went to. So it's a slightly different experience this time. Not quite so. Well, we lost, but, you know, it was a nice trip.
Yeah, exactly. Brilliant stuff. Thank you both very much. I'm sure we'll keep updated with you and what you're doing. So thank you.
Yeah. Cheers, guys. Love the podcast.
Okay, just a couple of stories to finish up on. Christian Eriksen called up to the Denmark squad on Tuesday. The first time, obviously, he's been selected since he suffered cardiac arrest at the European Championships last year. Kasper Hjulmand included the midfielder in his 23-man squad that will play the Netherlands and Serbia in friendlies this month. Few questions for you. Ben says, hi, Podders. On the back of the thread you were discussing in a previous episode about young kids celebrating goals in ludicrous ways, I wanted to share this. I teach in a secondary school and the shithousery in the playground. How many times have we used that word in this pod today?
Not enough.
Is an absolute joy. I witnessed a year 7 student using one of those foam footballs that soak up any ephemeral puddles on the playing surface, chip the keeper from the edge of the area, to which he ran over to the crowd, by which I mean the fence that borders a busy junction, give them the cupped ears, then lift his school tie to the sky and kiss it. He then stopped by a small gang of year 7 girls and flexed his arms just in case they'd missed his earlier celebration. Such bliss. Thank you, Ben. I love that.
I think that's great. The cupping of the ears. Maybe he's been receiving a lot of criticism from the school media. You know, the school paper's been all over him. And, you know, you gotta stick it to him. I think this stuff is a good sign. So I remember playing as a small child on the playing fields of Norway. There was one guy that I played with fairly often who would like dive when we were playing five a side when we were young, and everyone was like, what are you doing? Like, there's no ref to con. But he actually went on to play professionally and none of us did, so, you know, maybe the joke's on us.
Yeah. Definitely. Andy says, finally, many species of wasp are like their cousins in the bee world in that they eat nectar and pollinate flowers. Some of them are complete bar stewards too, to be fair, though, usually inserting eggs into other creatures that when they hatch, eat said creature from the inside. Delightful. Still not an excuse, Wilson, though, to kill them, says Andy. That, of course, after Barry Glendenning revived a wasp with some sugary drink the other night and was not stung. Incredible, incredible scenes. Right, we're going to be back tomorrow covering Premier League and Champions League games that are on tonight. Thank you, Lars.
Thank you so much, Faye.
Thank you, Simon.
Cheers.
Thanks, as always, Jonathan.
Thank you, Faye.
And thank you, as ever. Our producer today is Joel Grove, and our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.